you very welcome back to the Greg Hughes podcast. Now, my guest today is a very proud Donegal man who's ridden the highest waves of the Irish music industry and lived to tell the tale. Over 20 years ago, he captured the nation's heart on You're a Star, leading to a massive number one hit and representing Ireland at the 2003 Eurovision Song Contest with We've Got the World. But a career in music is rarely a straight line. Today, we're going to dig into the reality of that whirlwind success, from the pressure of primetime TV and his relatively recent stint on Dancing with the Stars, to the massive industry decision that shaped his path, including a major crossroads where he walked away from a recording contract with Sony. We also talk about family, his pride in his son Percy, and the incredible legendary artists he's shared the studio with over the years, including a fascinating as yet unreleased collaboration with the late great Shane McGowan. He's candid, he's deeply passionate about his craft, and he's looking firmly towards his future ambitions in the industry. Right, now, when we come up with this idea of the Greg Hughes podcast, myself and Caroline, you come together and you think, well, who would you love to have on the show? And we, obviously, a name that came up straight away was our own Mickey Joe Hart, to get him into studio, to get him down for a chat in a bit of a longer format. And it's taken to now, but here you are, Mickey Joe Hart, singer, songwriter. Thank you so very much for calling in to chat to us.
Pleasure, Greg. Absolute pleasure. It's, I know we tried to get this in place for a bit.
Yeah, exactly.
I think you had to cancel. I had to cancel a few things, but that's
the
way.
That's the nature of showbiz.
That's it. Or we're just too tired. We just couldn't be bothered looking at one another.
My excuse was a good one. Kabir, as we're recording this, and people might listen to this in 6 months of the year or whenever, we're just off the back of the Eurovision Song Contest. And we're not in it. And you know, the funny thing is I completely disengaged with it once we weren't involved in it, and I didn't realise I would. We're doing the right thing, aren't we? Taking a stand along with Spain and others with everything that's going on in the Middle East. Are we doing the right thing in your view?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I was always, there's the old cliche where you shouldn't mix, music with politics and sport with politics, but it's really impossible to do that, especially with the arts. It's very hard to, as artists or as people that our job nearly as artists is to try and seek out, the truth and seek out people's needs and stuff like, and talk about them and expose them and, be that through songs and through poems and through, prose and writing and, journalism and all those things that are, come under the arts, if you want to put it like that. So it is a responsibility of ours to do that. And I think it just got to the stage where it was, it's impossible to see how, how Israel are part of this competition still, given the fact that, that Russia was 2 weeks into a war with Ukraine or whatever, and they were expelled from the competition straight away, So there's a huge amount of hypocrisy within the EBU on this, completely. And you don't know what kind of hold Israel has or what they have. And this is not to say that there are all bad people within the Israel camp. I know some of the people, and one or two of them very well. I actually got to know them over the years, and I still stay in touch with them and try to, try to keep them aware of the narrative that we're getting here and the kind of stuff like that. And my stance was on it since last year as well, that we can't be part of this. And it's quite, five countries in total got involved and opted out. And it's a little bit disappointing that there weren't many more. And that's probably the biggest, the biggest problem that we had is that, if there had been 8 or 10 countries, I think
it starts making a difference, doesn't it?
Yeah, yep. It does. That would have made, and I think we were, I think we made the right decision. Whatever happens, even if there was only ourselves that did it, it was the right thing to do. But the fact that four other countries, I think it throws a bit of weight behind it. It's just, unfortunate that other countries didn't, see fit to do that.
But the only thing we can do, I suppose, well, not the only thing, is just be on the right side of history.
Yeah,
as a country.
Yeah, and you can only make your own decisions based on your on what you're seeing in front of you and in your own country and your own infrastructure within the Eurovision and your own moral compass and all those kind of things as a country and as a republic and as a nation that were colonised and all those kind of things. So, you know, we have a lot of solidarity, as you know, and the republic certainly with Palestine and certain parts of the north, and you know there is, and I know we always have that that struggle to explain or to try and keep people, everybody happy, I suppose, in terms of you know, there are people not too far from us who would disagree completely with that stance, you know, and that's fine too. That comes, you know, from a very, you know, difficult and bloodied history that we've had in this country. So, you know, but I think overall, we've made the right decision, and it's unfortunate that more people, because I think it would have forced the EBU's hand had more countries join, but that's where it is, and I think it was the right stand, and it was a good place, you know.
And finally, I mean, obviously, Israel finished second, and they did try and adjust the voting whereby, you know, more went to the judges, less to the public. So I presume that would be to offset, you know, technology or campaigns to try and swing the vote, because people don't think it's significant, but it is actually incredibly significant, because it's a way of sort of reputation washing or whatever you might want to describe it. So I don't know how Israel finished second, or maybe I don't understand that. Maybe that's a country that people support more than maybe we in this country realise.
No. There's something, certainly definitely something going on, because that, you know, if you look at the stats up until you know, in the last few years, that wasn't the case. Israel, you know, they were always a strong contender, you know, wasn't that they were, from year to year, like most of the draft in and out. But if you look at the stats, that certainly doesn't ring true. So, you know, to have this spike, as you want to say, in popularity, you know.
It's just a little bit too convenient.
Yeah, it is. And the other thing is that it certainly could have radicalized, you know, the vote, if you want to say, out there on behalf of the Jewish community. And maybe the Jewish community, you know, in other parts of Europe are more, became more, I suppose, at play with it, you know, because it was something important to them. So people who would maybe have never, in the Jewish community or whatever, watched the Eurovision or any interest in whatsoever, maybe they thought, well, this is a way of us. So there can be a bit of that as well, that may be a way of us, you know, trying, but it feels like there's something untoward going on there, you know, but, you know.
Your involvement in the Eurovision Song Contest, I mean, it's absolutely huge, but it's not everything who you are, of course, that would be a stretch, but it'd be remiss of us not to reference it, and we have in the past, and you've talked about it extensively. Where does it sit? Where does that song sit for you now? Do you love it? Do you love performing it? You're so proud of it. Is it a weight around your neck, or what is it?
I there was a time, I suppose, after, I mean, sometimes you take yourself too seriously. And I've learned that that's one of the things that you shouldn't do. You should take maybe your work seriously, your art, and do that. But, you know, you shouldn't take yourself too seriously in terms of that. And it was something that I probably put too much emphasis on, insofar as that it was this song that it was very pop-based and very, and I was kind of like coming from this background of, you know, being a student of the rock school in Ballyfermot, and very much so into my singer-songwriter, acoustic-y rock sort of music. And then this song kind of diverted me a little
bit. Did it feel like a sellout at the time?
Yeah, probably did. You know, and maybe afterwards I tried to compensate with that and tried to, you know, not engage with the song as much as I could have. Or, you know, it's a tricky one, but...
You didn't want to be defined by it, I presume, either.
Yeah, and you will be, and it doesn't matter what I do, I will be.
The problem was? It's just a brilliant song.
Yeah, and that's...
And you have no control over it.
No,
and do you know, like, it's a very, very good song. Yeah. It gets played sometimes at the Highland Radio gigs, and Journey's played, and this song's played. That song, it's just a very, very good song.
Yeah, it's a very popular song.
So no matter what you wanted to do, you can't suppress this thing, right? No. Not that you wanted to, but it's a good song.
No, that's it. And, you know, I've learned that. I was kind of like, you know, you never know what's good for you sometimes, you know, because I mean, like at the start when I was presented with the song, when I was like doing the song and being part of it, I was kind of like saying, no, this is not the right direction, you know, for me. And I was like on the verges of pulling out of the whole Eurostar thing, and based on that. And it was ridiculous when I think of it. But, you know, it's...
But you're a much more mature person now.
Yeah.
And you've all that life experience. You know, you can imagine if you can place yourself back as that younger Mickey Joe Hart, you can understand where that was coming from too.
Oh, completely. You know, and it's like... And I like that. I like that part of me as well. Like, and I like the reasons why I was doing it. But as you go on and as you talk to people... who are way more, you know, well-known or famous or have huge amounts of success, who are, you know, at the top ends. And they always say to you, oh, Jesus, there's this song, you know, and, you know, they have this song that they, you know, be it the Undertones, Teenage Kicks, and I'm not saying the boys would jump at on the same level, but, you know, that's something that they have to do and they stick it in the middle of their set.
Yeah.
Because they don't want that to define the set or the night or that to be the finale sort of thing, because there's so many brilliant songs. But... it's just another example of, and you know, there are so many people out there, and everybody I talked to that had that one big hit, you know, or one or two songs.
But do you know what I've observed, Mickey Joe? I'm not sure if you agree, but like, if I could think of other artists, say, for instance, that you could probably define by one song, Rick Astley might be one, right?
Yes.
That Hawk guy, what's his name? But anyway, that'll come back to me in a second. I think for the generation that they created that song for, they can be sort of locked into to one-hit wonders. But what we're seeing more and more is artists like Rick Astley completely reinventing themselves because they're bringing forward a whole new amount of work to a new audience that don't just see them as that one-hit wonder. So I wonder, is it generational?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny, you know, because, I mean, I feel that there's, you know, the song We've Got the World, there's people coming, you know, younger people that should not know the song.
That's,
you know,
crazy, yeah.
At gigs and stuff, and they're coming up 17, 18-year-olds or whatever, you know, this song is, what, 2003, so it's, what, 23 years old, let's say. And I see, you know, young ones coming up and at gigs or at university gigs, and they know it because mom and dad has heard it, or they've heard it at discos or weddings or whatever it might be, or it's just on the radio. And it's kind of like one of those songs that every so often regurgitates itself or whatever and finds a new audience. And I'm just the kind of vehicle that, you know, presents this thing and the original, you know, it's one of those songs as well, luckily enough, that there hasn't been a lot of versions of, you know, people haven't really covered it. So
that's actually really quite an interesting point.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Because I don't know, and I'm kind of happy that that's happened.
Is it because it's so synonymous with you? But then again, people have recorded...
Yeah,
all
I mean,
if it's
like, for example, let's say Galway Girl.
That's true.
Although, you know, Mundy's version is, you know, the version that a lot of us are you know, Steve Earle's obviously wrote the song. That's, you know, his version is quintessentially the version. But Mundy's version is the version of Sharon Shanney. The one that people will say. But there are 1,000 versions of there out there, and everybody sings it and everybody plays it, and so it's that's, you know, a different type of thing. But for We've Got the World, for some reason, it's had a few remixes and a few people
I
have
like
done it,
some
and,
of the remixes.
But they've always kind of used my voice.
Do you know what?
Or my versions.
They might have sped it up slightly, kept the pitch, a bit of a beat behind it, but fundamentally, it's your song.
Yeah,
they haven't gone crazy with the successful remixes.
Absolutely. So it's fine like that. So it's always been, even for a younger audience, it's always been me that's presented or they've heard singing it. So that's kind of good for me. So
I mean, I've kind of fallen into the trap here to some extent in talking about that song and talking about it extensively. But I mean, you have had and continue to have an amazing career with songs that have caught on recently, you know, producing songs that get, like, when I say producing, I mean outputting songs, you know, they're getting plenty of radio play. That's another thing maybe we can talk about. You know, so you're still out there, still performing, still gigging, really. And you're far more than that song now. Obviously, not that you were ever just that song, but...
Yeah. Well, I wasn't always just that song, and that's not... But that song has defined me, and I don't mind that. You know, people will say to me, I'm walking down the street and people sing We've Got the World, I'll hear them in the distance, they'll say, and I'm fine with it. It brings a smile to my face, genuinely, and I've just, you know, I always say it's great that they're singing at me and not throwing stuff at me, you know what I mean? So it's always a plus, and it doesn't matter, and it's one of those songs, and I love that fact, so I'm completely... I've completely kind of embraced that now and kind of got over the whole thing about, you know, taking it too seriously. And I kind of love that aspect of it. And I just love seeing people out dancing to it at discos. And, you know,
I'm in the back of the hall
and maybe not even know I'm there at a bar. I was in Killarney, funny enough, a few months ago. And I went into, I'd done a gig and it was near NEC, you know, down, and I went into just the, down the town, went to a bar. And there's a DJ guy there, a guy called Brendan Fuller, who's on Kerry Radio as well, Brendan, for years. And I just happened to know that he was then doing a gig that night. And I just went into the bar and kind of sneaked into the back and had a pint, you know. And I was looking up, and the next thing, the song came on. And I said, oh, shit, he knows I'm here. He knows I'm here. And I said, oh, Christ, that song came on. So that was all right at the end of the night. And he came down, and some of the bouncers went up to him and said whatever. And he said, I genuinely didn't know you were here. He said, we always play that song. But it was just standing in the back of the bar in this song, and I could see everybody going crazy to it and just going, wow, you know, I'm so fortunate to be this, you know,
so
in this
position.
You're out
socializing and you're down the country, Spain, Lanzarote, wherever the hell you might be, right? Mm. There's a band playing and you're there enjoying it. You're there with your family, your friends, or whatever it might be. After a couple of bevvies or even without it, do you kind of go, I could go up there and sing a song?
Yeah.
Do you? I've always wondered about that. Yeah.
Some, you know, it's weird. Sometimes it depends what just depends on the
just
vibe.
To perform. Like, you know, I guarantee I could have everyone here up on this.
Yeah, yeah. I love that. And sometimes that happens and it works out lovely. And it normally works out okay enough that, you know, the buzz, and I have no issues with it. And like the family are so used to it now, they just go,
here he goes.
There's that. Jesus, there's away. And that's fine. And, you know, it's kind of funny because they almost expect it now. And if it doesn't happen, it's kind of like, oh, what happened? And you can, some of the bands are you say, I didn't want to have you up. I didn't want to intrude.
You enjoy your night.
Either way it works, I don't mind, you know what I mean, but I've done that many a time, and it's a lovely buzz. And, you know, bands and musicians are so kind, and, you know, I've done a few things now where I've opened up the first dance for a wedding, so maybe someone who gets getting married now who were teeny boppers back in the time that you know, you hang around long enough, they end up getting married and have special occasions or whatever. So, and the bands, all of the bands are so cool with it, you know, coming up to do the first dance, because I'm kind of intruding on their opening set, and I feel a bit, but they're so cool with it. They're like, oh, Jesus, this is great. And I suppose in a way, it starts the night for them too. It lifts the, you know, and it's kind of a vibe.
It's also,
but, you know,
like,
but it's,
what a gift for a couple getting married, because, you know, like, you are a star. Do you know what I mean?
Well, because
you see, sometimes, you know, you're quite accessible, right? Mm. And we have other people like, you know, Daniel O'Donnell. Yeah. You know, these are well-known national personalities, international, but still retain an accessibility. Mm. If that makes sense. I'm not sure I'm phrasing it correctly.
No, you're right.
But, you know, you have a star, but at the same time, you know, you know, you don't define yourself by it.
But
as
I think
such.
You learn
down to earth.
Yeah, but you think you learn that too. You know, and you realize, you know, because whenever things kicked off for me, and, you know, I was kind of, you go into a sort of initially, because you don't know what celebrity is, if you know what I mean. Mm. I put that in a very, very small, you know, when I say celebrity, but you don't know what success is, and all of a sudden it comes. So then you're trying to find a way of understanding it and protecting it, you know, and try and protect yourself and your family and your kids and all the people around. I was quite lucky when it happened to me that there wasn't this sort of social media type of thing.
Yeah, I agree.
And I'm very fortunate of that. So I learned to sort of navigate that before I had to deal with social media or whatever. So I was lucky that way. So, but you do, and you kind of like, you put up this barrier and the buffer, and you have a manager and your thing, and you try it, and you have a record label, and you try to sort of protect yourself. It's not that you don't want to be accessible, but you're trying to put something up there so that you're not exposed, because you don't understand how to navigate it because you're very young, very new. And so that's all it was, you know. So, and I remember being in a radio station, and I won't say it, down the country, and one of the DJs kind of jarred me about it. He said, you know, we got in touch with your label, and at the time, and, you know, Sony, whatever, you know, this was big, and they completely wouldn't let you into the show. And I said, but, you know, I knew nothing about that.
That's a bit unfair to challenge you. You should have, they...
Yeah, it wasn't on air, it was off air, he kind of said it to me, but I understood where he was coming from, but it's like... you know, I genuinely had no idea that that was a fact that that had happened, because I would have tried to address it if I had to have. But and because, you know, the value of having radio stations on your side as well. But they would have maybe been saying, picking their favourites or ones that they had worked with or certain DJs. And that's how the...
But you also know, too, sometimes, I presume this is where the record company is coming from, you create an aura. Sometimes less is more.
Yeah.
You know, and I get that. And I think that's fine. Yeah, and I think absolutely. Most people might understand that. It's completely separate, but, you know, like, it's not the same thing, but it is kind of in a way. Catherine Connolly, up until she ran for election, you just ring her up, come on the programme, no problem. But now she's the president.
Yeah.
There's a protocol, there's a system. As I say, it's completely different, but people understand that. Yeah,
and the other thing is that you only have so many hours in the day.
Yeah.
And I remember, I'll give you this little example. I remember being auditioning for Eurostar, which was the precursor to Eurovision and all that competition that I won to allow me to do all that. But I remember contacting the local papers, like the Democrat and stuff like that, and saying, like, and they would have been aware of me at a bit, you know, doing the scene here, only, you know, in a small way. But I was proactive, and I was for 8 or 10 years before that doing the circuit. But, you know, the guys were, I mean, and what is it? And I was saying, well, it's a program called Eurostar. It's on RTE, and it's going to go out, and I need, you know, a bit of help because there's a local vote kind of thing there's going to be. And, you know, you'd get a little column in page 13 or something like that. And then whenever Eurostar kicked in, and about halfway through it, when it started to snowball, it just became this huge, big program. The difference was I'd turn on my phone and there'd be 30 messages.
Yeah.
Can you do an interview? Can you do an interview? I want you.
Were you sore about that?
No, I wasn't sore. It was just like...
I know it's great, but...
It was great. Yeah, but it's like... No, I certainly wasn't like sore because I understood.
Sure, I wouldn't have been.
Yeah, yeah. But it was... I don't think... No, it was just the fact that... And then it's like... How do I manage my time? Because there's so many demands. So it goes, you know, it's hand in hand. You're trying to manage your time. You're trying to, you know, have time for your family, have time for yourself. And what you end up doing in that, what happened to me certainly was that I ended up diluting myself. And, you know, you're better to sort of, you know, be something, you know, try and keep something a wee bit more, I suppose, potent, as it were, and pick out the ones that you think that are best. And, you know, sometimes you can say yes to everything. You end up diluting yourself and you're good for nobody.
Yeah,
and that's
exactly.
That's the problem when the demand comes. And I know what that's like because we had a huge demand for like that year of Eurostar and Eurovision where it was just everybody wanted you. Every charity wanted you to come and do something. Every, you know, we did a lot of stuff with the Special Olympics that year, which was really, you know.
But that was something that you says, right, well, from the time I have, this is something I can give that time to.
Yeah. You know, that was something that we were very close to and for my own personal reasons as well. So I tried to do as many of those kind of Special Olympics things and we ended up doing the closing ceremony in Croke Park and stuff and all those things. Mm. So I have great memories of that. But, you know, there's a huge demand, so I can understand why people have to.
I will say straight out, if people can accuse maybe musicians, and I'm not saying this was perceived as being up the own arse, you'll never meet a group of individuals that can be up their arse more than journalists and radio presenters.
Yeah.
That is just a fact. Because really, they're all drinking from the same pond, but on different levels.
Yeah.
And everyone has this notion of their own self-importance.
Yeah.
Not everyone, but you know.
No, I know there is. There is a media thing there as well, absolutely. Yeah. And we very quickly, not very quickly, but you know, it's funny, there's, you know, we would have these people say, oh, you know, be careful of him, because you know, because they'll try and do a spin on that or something like that. And you know, I won't mention any names, but I remember Louis one time coming in and saying to us, avoid this particular guy. He was very specific about this particular person, and he wasn't wrong, you know. Well, and so, and that was just experience. And he was giving us a wee bit of, like, you know, be careful what you say to this. But and so those little things. So you have. You kind of learn because we have our own, you know, musicians, like you have your own circles. You know, somebody will say, oh, he's a fucking asshole. Be careful what he say because he'll try and spin this or she'll try and spin this. So be careful. So there are kind of mechanisms that, you know, and you fairly quickly find out who
do. And do you know what? I mean, you know, as bad as it could be in this country, I mean, can you imagine what it was like in England?
Oh, my God.
And still is to some extent, but when the News of the World was about and the Sunday People and...
Oh, I mean, it's just on a totally different level, you know.
But you got a taste of it.
I got a small taste of it, yeah. But I can only imagine what it would be like for, you know, the likes of the David Beckhams and all that kind of stuff, and all these, the, you know, people who are on the Bonos and all those kind of things, and they just have to so try and protect themselves.
Do you think you've struck the sweet spot of fame in that, you know, you can do your gigs, you can go out and plug music, you can get an entire room up on their feet, you know you can do your media interviews, whatever you might be, but at the same time too you can go and chill out in Downing's or at home or is there a sweet spot you're in there, do you think?
Yeah, and I think that just comes with, you know, it's, my success is primarily an Irish thing. You know, it's not an international thing, really. You know, and it's like here now in Donegal or at home, some people, you know, nobody really even takes a second look anymore, which is fine. The odd time you might be someone that want a picture or something like that, and that's fine. Go down the country, you might pop into a bar, there could be 20 people want a picture, there could be nobody.
Yeah.
And that's just the way it is. But I always say the first 5 or 10 minutes in a bar, and that's it. Because after that, people just leave you alone. They might want to, you've popped into their kind of space and they want to kind of check out and see what kind of person you are and ask you for a picture and maybe have a little conversation, and then they leave you alone. And that's the great thing, you know, it's never become a huge issue for me. There were times where we had to extract ourselves from situations or whatever, and myself and my missus or whatever, and you just try and get out of there because you realise you're not going to win.
So you know? If you potentially sold out in 2003, you completely threw your hands up in 2007.
Yeah.
I'm only messing. But you talked about sort of, you know, I suppose finding you after the success of the Eurovision, and then you appeared on Celebrities Go Wild.
Yes.
Is this always about a platform for your music?
Yes.
That's the core thing, isn't
absolutely.
It, right?
It's not about, honestly, and you know, people say it's not about recognizing, you know, celebrity or trying to be a celebrity. I've never had really any interest in that. You know, it's genuinely, and the older you get, the less interested you are in it, honestly. And because you know, you just realize again, you reconnect with the important things. Yeah, when you're young and what happens, you're going, Jesus, this is great, and here I am. And, you know, everybody thinks I'm amazing and all that kind of stuff that goes on in your head. And then you very quickly realize that, wow, there are so many pitfalls in this industry and so many pitfalls. And it was a tough time. I had a huge big year too. And then, you know, the phone stops ringing.
Yeah.
And that's really hard. And no one ever asks you really. I think my mum asked me once, are you okay? Kind of thing, you know, and I think and I was able to kind of,
I think it's what sports people get after retirement. It's that, is it relevance or is it, I've lost the momentum here or?
Yeah. The momentum is a big thing as well. And then, you know, we made I was with Sony and I always say...
What did they want from you?
Well, I mean, we left Sony to set up my own label, you know, or I left Sony and we set up my own label. And I never regret that, you know. And
but
I
did
still
they say we want an album? We want
I'm sorry, not, you know, with hindsight, it's a great thing, as you know. But we did, the first album, it was number one and we had a number one single and everything was great. Biggest selling single in the country. And then we went in to have a meeting with them afterwards and they wanted to do a second album. Was like I had a 5-album deal with them. They wanted to do the second album, but they didn't want to pay me my advance. And I was saying, what am I going to live off? You know, I know there's gigs and stuff. They sort of said, well, if they were like that. And I was thinking, well, here's I had a number one album. I've had a number one single with the biggest selling single. And still, you know, they're telling me that we've lost. Yeah. I just, I'm not going to be able to improve on that. So I was kind of like, but they did want to do a second album, and I'll be honest with you, Greg, I'm probably sorry I didn't do the second album with them, because the reality was when we set up my own label and we Swerve and all that, and we put a lot of time and a lot of money. I invested all of kind of the gigging money, and I just was putting everything back in. I wasn't taking anything out. I probably should have went off and built, you know, my big mansion I could have probably at the time, but I was so focused on putting everything back in.
But you were true to you, though.
Yeah, I was. And myself and my manager, it wasn't that we were just throwing money around and we were trying to, we were very conscious about it and we were making decisions and we were getting people to help with us. But, you know, it just became that. I always remember getting into HMV and in Grafton Street, and we'd just released the album, the second album and the single and that. And previous to that, when it was Sony, you'd open the doors would open up in HMV, and the first album you would see of that week would be my album with whoever else's, was Beyonce's and all. You'd be up there, and that was the power of having somebody like Sony. When I had my own label, the album was down the back of the shop.
That machine wasn't there.
That machine wasn't there.
Which you paid for, I think, well, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think when you sign a big deal with a record company, a lot of that comes out of your deal.
Yeah.
Isn't that right?
You get an advance, you know, and it's great. And it wasn't a huge advance, but it was enough. You know, it was kind of like, you know, it was a little bit of a, you know, buffer. You weren't able to go off and, you know, and as a man says, sail into the sunset. But it was a bit of a buffer at the time, and it was great, you know, because I was young and I'd always had to struggle, you know, to get money. So it paid the bills for a few months, I suppose, those advances. But it was never that huge. And then I suppose the pressure of just being with the label, and I think all those things kind of, you have to weigh it up.
Coalesced into a
tuffle. You have to kind of try and weigh it up and figure out whether, but you know, I probably would have liked to have done a second album with them and then seen where it would have went, because they can also open up doors, and as a songwriter and a performer, you know, you can get they can get you with people,
collabs,
get you on, support things, and they've just so.
So you don't.
Yeah, it was a bit hasty.
You wish you had done the second album, but you don't regret your decision.
I don't regret it now, and so far.
I do regret it.
You know, there's no point in me saying I don't regret it, because I do. I often wonder what would have, because the songs were better, the second album was better, it was a more mature album. I think it would have, you know, I remember playing it to a few people, or getting it into the hands of a few people, and, you know, them coming back to good, serious people and saying, man, this is, wow, you know, this is fantastic, okay, you know, I want to work with you, you know, I just want to figure out with the labels if we're okay. And then people are kind of like in that business. You, if they know you're with Sony or something, say, okay, yeah, there's a possibility.
But even
of
now,
us
saying it, it's like, oh, you're with Sony.
Yeah, you know. So and so that changes a bit. So yeah, I was, you know, yeah. I look back and I don't, you know, I don't lose any sleep over it anymore. But it's like one of those things. You often wonder, that was a bit hasty, you know. And we thought we were doing the right thing based on the analysis of the first album and all that. And we kind of had this option of 2 weeks to get out of the contract, and we sort of bit the bullet and said, okay, let's set up our own label.
And it could have gone a good way. It could have been the worst decision you ever made either.
Yeah.
You know, so, and that's the thing about it.
Absolutely.
And that's why I can trouble, because you simply don't
know. You don't know. And the label, you know, we still have Swerve and it's still active. And so maybe that's, you know, a good thing. But funny enough, I reconnected with Sony on a different thing in the last year. So
been in the office altogether.
It's weird. I've been in the offices again. There's one guy that still works there that remembers. He says, oh, I used to be here when you were in there. All the rest of the staff are completely changed.
Did Celebrities Go Wild any good? Good thing to be involved
in? I was, yeah. You know what? I'll tell you why it was good. You get to know a few people. One of the things that I take from it is that Katie French, who died not long after that, she was a model, and Katie was a great girl. And
that was a terrible tragedy.
Oh, terrible, absolutely. And it broke our hearts. And but she was an incredible person. She was great fun, and I struck up a great friendship with her. And she used to organize these shows, you know, and she was very proactive. She would just, you know, lift the phone, oh, we'll do a show on such and such. And she would put four or five of us together. I remember us being in Kerry somewhere, in Dingle or somewhere, and Dave Fanning and Brendan O'Connor and myself. And you know, she'd say, get you up and sing, and I'll come up and sing. And, you know, and she would sell these packages. And she was a real doer, and she would sell these packages. And she'd ring you up and say, oh, we're in Mullingar this week, come on. And she would kind of have these things going on, and she'd just include you in them.
What a buzz.
Oh, brilliant. And it was just, you know, she's great. And she just died so quickly. And, you know, it was so tragic what happened. And it was in the middle of all that. And but coming off the back of Celebrities Go Wild, not a lot of people know this. We went in, got everybody together. Victoria Mary Clark was part of it, who's Shane McGowan's girlfriend. And Victoria, I always got on really well with Victoria. She was a bit wacky. It was good fun, you know, and great crack. And she didn't want to conform at all to what they were telling her. So she left it then after a couple of days or something. So, but we stayed in touch. But afterwards, she sort of said, maybe we should do a charity single for them. You know, it was all for Telethon at the time, if you remember that. That was like a charity, like a big, the Red Nose Day, or whatever you call that. Similar thing. And So maybe we can do a charity single. And I was going, oh, I could hear alarm bells ringing, you know, charity singles, you know, what they're about. And then I said, I'm not sure charity singles can be a bit of hit and miss. And she said, well, so Shane said he would get involved and would do one of his songs. And then that changed everything. I said, well, that's different, you know. So we did, and I ended up producing it with a pal and Shane as well. And we were in Selbridge and Marion Guinness's house, you know, we're part of the Guinness dynasty. It was Keyless Studio. They had a studio set up there, Victoria was able to organize all of that. And then I just got the band together, as it were, called in a few favors, and we did this single, one of Shane's songs, and everybody sang, including Katie, and all the Celebrity Go Wild crowd, they all sang, and Michael Heady Ray and myself and Dahi O'Shea and all these people, we got everybody together, Tony Kenny, and we had this lovely kind of gathering of people. And then a few days later, Victoria rang me up and she said, Shane wants to do a B-side, he's never done Danny Boy. And I said, okay. I said, geez, I don't know if I'm going to be able to call in all these favors, the band. You know, she said, she just wants you with the guitar and him.
Wow.
Can you come? And I was in Dublin doing a thing with RT every Tuesday at the time. And I said, okay, I'll pick him up because they lived out there in Donnybrook, right close. So I picked him up and we went out to Selbridge, to the studio. And we were really late getting there, you know, by the time we'd get Shane picked up and all the stuff done. We had a bit of dinner. We did Danny Boy, myself and him, and I had that recording. And it's just funny you should mention that, because about a month ago I came across them again, and I got in touch with Victoria and I sent her on the stuff. So I have them and she has them now, so I don't know what's going to become of them. But
so they were never released?
They were never released because Katie died about a week afterward, and we all kind of, there was a decision made. We sort of said some people wanted to release it. I didn't want to release it because I just thought it wasn't, this is not,
you couldn't
gonna,
make it feel, yeah, right.
The song wasn't right either. It was quite, it's one of Shane's songs. There was a bit of talk about down on the ground and all these kind of things.
Yeah, yeah.
And it, you know, the narrative on it, the lyric on it and all that. So and in other contexts, it would have worked perfectly well, but it never got released and it hasn't ever been released yet.
Yeah.
So.
And do you think it will ever be, was that of a time? Is there any space where, I mean, obviously, thinking, focusing more, about the collab between you and Shane on Danny Boy, because I can only imagine what that's like, right?
Yeah.
But the charity, is that of a time now?
It's of a time, I think, and it was like, I mean, Victoria has them now, so it's up to her, and it's really, they're Shane's songs, and then Danny Boy is just in copyright control, but so it would be up to her completely, you know, if she has them, and I don't know, and I didn't put any precursors on them. I just said, listen, I have these and I want you to have them. I don't want anything, and I don't want anything out of it. I don't want anything. If it gets released, that would be my reward.
Do you both sing on Danny Boy?
No.
You accompany him, he sings.
I just accompany him on guitar.
Not just, it's quite significant.
Yeah, it was just a version that we did. We were very, he wanted it very basic, you know, and I remember, you know, because Danny Boy can have a lot of minors and a lot of fancy. There's so many versions out there. You can do so many things with it, you know. And I remember doing these fancy chords and stuff, and he'd go, hold on. Just play the major there and not the minor. And stuff.
So he kind of wanted almost a cappella, but you adding...
Just enough to sort of add it along, and it was lovely. And I listened to it now, and he was so right.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, you know, I mean, people sometimes put him down for a fool, you know, or whatever, you know, because he's that good persona, and he wasn't, and when you had him for that hour of his energy, and, you know, he would kind of zone out for a bit, and we'd do other things in the studio, and then he'd come back, but when you had him, when he was up for that hour, he was just incredible, you know, and that energy just off him, it was a great buzz, and it's...
Was it difficult to be around him?
No.
Pleasure? He would just chill out a bit?
He was just had his own, if you just, you know, I mean, if you're expecting a lot of things of him, maybe that was it. If, you know, I don't know what it'd been like to. I mean, he sang on the charity single as well. He was all part of that. I have some great photographs of that time on the studio and us all around the mics and stuff
amazing.
Like that.
So I mean, it might never see the light today, that side of it. But what an amazing thing. You still have the memory, whether it's a commercial success or not, it's irrelevant. That's locked in for you, isn't it? That's amazing.
And we had a great band together, you know, and of different people, and and some of his band, and one of the girls there, Catch was like the one that he was there. She played bass on the day, you know, with us, and I remember he was, Shane was a wee bit reluctant to, like, you know, because there was a lot of musicians was pulling in, so he was kind of like, who's this guy, who's this? And then she very quickly, because I ended up kind of being at the center of it and kind of producing it and kind of pulling it together, because kind of, there was no one else that had could do it on that particular group of, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not that there weren't better people for the job, but I ended up being that kind of person. And I remember Shane's reluctant, he was a wee bit reluctant, obviously, because he was getting to know me as well. And but I remember Catch just saying to him, no, this guy, Shane, this guy knows what he's doing. You've got to trust him. And it was that moment, and she sort of just went, and she could feel it, I knew what I was doing, or she felt like, okay, and she felt comfortable. And then once he knew that she felt comfortable, because he was, you know, she was in the band with him for years and stuff like that, he relaxed completely. And it was like that moment I always remember, just that, okay, that was a kind of an endorsement that he needed from somebody close to him. But I always remember Catch just doing that. And she was part of the band on the day. But we had this, yeah, this great experience with him. Yeah, you know, it's just nice that I have those things, and especially the Danny Boy thing, because it was just me and him and a couple engineers that night, you know, that day, or we spent a whole, to 4 in the morning, I think.
But I think also it's not just him singing, you performing. To have that memory of the intimate process, of the process of getting to what you finished, sounds to me like what would be really special.
Yeah.
You know, do you like that? You know, in his own inimitable way, it's a beautiful thing, and no one else has that. You have that with this song and that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think at the time you just kind of get on with it. You don't really think it's, when looking back now, and you know the kind of weight that he holds and the legacy that he has, and just to have, you know, just to be in that space for a couple of weeks and just being, you know, that.
It's a great gift.
Yeah, and it was just lovely. So, yeah, great memories. But hopefully, we might hear it, you never know.
Yeah, I think so. Obviously, your second venture out into reality TV, and I'm jumping over a lot here, but we can go back, was 2024, Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah.
How did that come about? And again, was this another opportunity to say, do you know what? I've got an album brewing here.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't really. Funny enough, I just was listening. Billy McGuinness was on, listening to him coming down the road there, and he was talking about the Out of Aslan, you know, Billy. And he had done it a few years during COVID. And he was saying, and he was very, you know, he's very honest, Billy's very straight. And he said, well, it was basically like this. It was COVID. There was nothing else happening, and I needed the money. So I don't think I can better that explanation.
Yeah, exactly.
But no, it was. I'll tell you exactly what it was. Shin and Will do Dancing with the Stars. They also produced Eurostar back in 2003, and to be honest, that was their kind of their trump card at the time. That was what propelled them. And Larry Bass, who's still in charge of and put that whole thing, Cineworld, together, his company, he will tell you that as well himself, that Eurostar kind of propelled them into the next stratosphere as an independent TV production. And, you know, and they've done so much stuff over the years since that. And so a few years ago, I was, whatever, 2024, I was down in Cork. I'll try and make this as simple as, I was doing a thing in the Everyman, and Jake Carter was on it, and it was one of your sisters, I think Red FM, one of those that they have a podcast, and they had this live thing in the Everyman studio, and the girl's a fan, and I said, okay, we'll go down and do it. And Jake Carter was on it, and then Karen was there, his girlfriend, who's one of the judges now on. And she said to me, just kind of, and Marty Morrissey was on at the same night. So there was this panel sort of people, and we were all there doing our thing, having the crack. And then she said after, have you ever done Dance with the Stars? And I said, no. She said, but Larry loves you. And you know, he's always, and I said, yeah, I know. I said, it's been muted, but, and I said, but I've never, I said, it's maybe not for me. And I just left it. That was kind of a conversation. And about a week later, the phone went, it was Larry. And I just completely, I went, oh, Karen's been talking to him, sort of in his ear saying, why don't you ask Mickey Joe again? And he came back to me and he just said, listen, and I have a great time for Larry.
Was
so
it hard? Yes, though, straight off. Or did
no,
you feel
I didn't.
You were
no,
paying
I
paying him back. For
I had a think, and he knew I would have to have a think about it as well, and not, you know, that I'm sure there were people, there's bigger names that he was asking than me, but he just said to me, I'm not sure if we're going to get commissioned again. So he, you know, and he said, "I really don't know." He said, "But so this could be the last term. Maybe that was a pitch, but I don't know." He
probably
was, you
said
know,
that to all the guys.
Yeah, yeah, probably. But in fairness, Larry's always been very straight with me. And he kind of say, I'm
"I think
not
at
sure.
that time there was question marks." I think that probably was accurate because it question marks over Arty's finances, and there was a lot of coverage at that time of the spend on and
absolutely,
and you know the public. Yeah. Generally don't necessarily see the financial return from that. They're just seeing the headline of how much the outlay is.
Yeah.
What have you. So he probably was thinking, you know, is this you know, the gravy train over here now?
Yeah, so. It's a big, you know, budget, one of the bigger ones. Yeah. I think it's 5 million or something like that, which isn't, in the grand scheme of things, isn't really when you break it all
change,
down.
But, yeah.
It really is. But it's when you see the amount of production and the amount of employment that it creates and the expertise that it brings into the country for new people coming in, new Irish people, and you know, I know they bring in a lot of their people, so it's a huge production, and you can just see, wow, there's a lot of people learning a lot of things here that'll help our industry or help the, you know, so it's a huge, it's the only way you can really, you know, progress the industry, be that television or music even, you know, or film, is by getting in the expertise, and the only way you have that is when you have big budgets or when people commit to these things. And you know, so for that, I seen the positive side of that, but I can understand why people saying, "Oh, you know, there's a lot of money to put onto a dancing show." So, but anyway, he didn't know if he was going to get permission, so he said it might be the last time. Would you? And like, I just have so much respect for Larry. I just had to think about it over the weekend and spoke to Louise and spoke, you know, and sort of got a bit of feedback and got the okay and sort of said, yeah, okay, I'll go for it, you know.
So. You enjoy it?
I did. I loved it. I'm just I'm disappointed I didn't stay any longer.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, no, I you know what? It's a great, I like staying kind of fit and stuff like that as well. I do like cycling and the challenge, and I used to play a bit of soccer and a bit of, you know, so I do that, I do a bit of swimming and all. So it was kind of another way of, you know, I suppose challenging myself as well in that respect and just seeing.
And it is a challenge as well.
Yeah, you're 50, you know, I'm 50. So, you know, you're kind of, I know I'm not the old man of the road, but at the same time, you're kind of thinking, geez, these are things, skills that I don't know if I'm going to be. You
hips
know,
and knees of your best years behind you.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, you aren't far away from being a cripple with a bad back.
Absolutely. You're so right, and you just.
No, I'm only joking. I'm speaking about myself.
No, but it is.
Here.
It's funny, you know, and they're asking you to do things of your body that you've never done before, and your brain.
I yeah. think you are quite private. Are you a private person, or is it just that your private life is private? Do you class yourself as a closed book, or you're very open, or how would you describe yourself?
I wouldn't say I'm private. I'm guarded.
Yeah.
You know, I'm guarded.
So
you know, that's
the impression I got, and I wanted to sort of not misread the room. You decided to do something, and I think it was a big deal. You dedicated, or maybe for you it wasn't, but I'm interested in your views. You dedicated your final performance to your son, Percy. Mm. Percy transitioned from female to male.
Mm-hmm.
Why was that important to you? Why then? And you know, what was the bigger picture there for you?
Yeah, there was this dedication week that I didn't get as far to, that they it was going to be another couple of weeks down the line that we had spoke about.
Yeah.
And Percy was going to come in from London and stuff like that just to be there and to okay it as well. But, you know, I spoke to him about it first of all because they said to me, you know, there's a dedication week. Have you anything in mind? And I said, yeah, I said I would like to dedicate it to Percy, you know. You know, people dedicate to their mums and all that.
Of
my
course,
mum knows
yeah.
I love her dearly and all those kind of things. And I could dedicate to people.
Who would might benefit most from this
yeah.
as well? And
the community yeah. that would benefit most from it as well. And I just felt that... you know, when you have a child who goes through that and you can see, you become very passionate about it. You know, there's something, you know, that you feel like you need to stand up for your child as well or somebody. And Percy's was so brave, you know, and just that transition that he made at the time and that, you know, bravery of coming to us. And also the fact that he was able to come to us, came to his big sister, first of all, kind of spoke to them.
How did you deal with it?
At the time, I'll tell you now, Greg, it was a tricky time for us. My mother-in-law was going through treatment for cancer and she wasn't going to do well, and she didn't.
Yeah.
So she was in her last few kind of months and weeks. So so for my wife, it was more difficult for Louise in terms of like...
Processing power.
Yeah, and just trying to get this whole thing about her mum and trying to deal with that. So we were trying to... I was trying to talk to Percy and saying, and you can't really say, can we just... Hold off on this for a little while. Do we, you know, to see what happens with Granny and, you know, all those kind of things, because that's a very different trigger. And she was so close to us, Louise's mom. She was there every day. She's one of those hands-on persons, you know, and she was great. You know, people tell jokes about their mother-in-law. I had a great mother-in-law. I always say, I had a great relationship. You know, I didn't have that, you know, so, and she was... So we all had, and we have very close to her and the grandkids, my kids and everything. You know, it wasn't like this granny that every so often popped in.
I know what you mean. You know, it was a different kind of the direct family circle.
Absolutely, all the same, and was really part of the family and the fabric of the house and all those kind of things. You know. And I was trying to kind of offset that and sort of say, hold back the tide a little bit and let's deal with this after, you know, whatever happens to Granny happens, you know what I mean? And then we can, but that's not how it played out, and that's not how things normally play out. But so we were trying to deal with that, and I'll deal with trying to support Percy more so than us dealing with it. And the change of name, she was Keola up until, and then you're trying to remember not to call him the wrong name, which is just the little fundamental bits of it. Then you just slip into Keola and you go, oh, Percy, you know, and you kind of correct, or he would correct.
That's going to take a time.
Takes a bit of time.
Misgendering,
yeah.
It's some things are hardwired, and it's going to, and a lot of people in the community understand that. It's about the intent.
Yeah.
Often, do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I don't know, some parents, as parents myself, Louise kind of went, okay, that's fine. We'll deal with this. You know, it'd be far worse if a child was coming in and something was wrong with the child, or there was.
I know what you mean.
You know, there were 100 other things. I said, this, you know, my child wants to change his name.
But in relation to that,
it doesn't really matter.
Do you worry now? Because when did that conversation with Percy happen?
Well, 60, 70. So let's say 5 years ago.
Five. So it's astonishing the change in 5 years, particularly in Britain. And normally what happens in Britain happens here. You know, there seems to be a massive anti-trans movement. We've seen recent high court judgments that, you know, define. It's often focused on what a woman is, right? But it affects people who transition either male, female, failed. With the rhetoric that's out there now, you know, led by a few, not least J.K. Rowling and others, do you worry about the future world that Percy has to navigate?
Yeah, I do worry, but I do think that this will come around again. Mm. You know, I do think that we're in a cycle at the minute, worldwide, globally, of... you know, there are so many things going on.
Liberalism, conservatism, liberalism.
Yeah, and it's like this full circle thing will happen. And I think we're in that stage where, it's very, it's worrying in some respect. But then, you know, at the end of this month, I'm doing a set at the Pride Fest. Last year, I marched with them here in Letterkenny. So, you know, I'm always trying to proactive. And, you know, you see this community of people that are very, very strong and very, very, you know, so there are these support structures. Mm. To be honest, you know, I grew up with people who were gay and could never come out when we were younger. At least there is support structures there now. There are people, it's difficult, but there are other people that, you know, are very proudly gay or trans or whatever it might be. I mean, 30 years ago, I'm thinking of one person in particular, from our town, from a community that I grew up with, a pal who just could never come out.
Actually, and lived a lie.
Effectively, just,
that,
you know.
That sounds almost, I don't mean like living a lie, but not living their true self.
No, absolutely. Yeah. I didn't get the opportunity, or just what, you know, and it came, you know, and you know, there are so many reasons for that I won't go into. But, you know, nowadays there seems to be at least, you know, there was places that Percy could go, and there was little community groups and support structures, be that in Derry or Letterkenny or, you know, Strabane, or, you know, and there was... So there is a kind of a network there that wasn't there. So for that, I'm very hopeful.
I think the pendulum was swinging really quite dramatically in different directions, and it has yet to settle in the middle, if you know what I mean. I think there was a massive push that made people pull back, and maybe it was too much too soon, and things have to calm down and the dust has to settle. And I'd say people in the gay community probably recognise that as well. But hopefully, listen, all we want is people to live their lives and be happy.
That's, I don't know why it bothers people so much. That's the big thing.
I think it's competing rights, you see.
That's weird.
You know, I think it's about rights being respected without rights encroaching on other people's rights. That seems to be what the focus is at. I don't get it. It doesn't impact me, but from what I see, and but it will hopefully sort itself out because you know, we all have to live these short lives we have, like these really short lives.
It doesn't really matter if I want to wear a dress or a pair of trousers, you know. It won't really affect you or me. You know, it only affects the person that that's in the middle of it, really, you know. So, and it's, but people like to observe and sort of make judgments, and it's very hard for them to get out of that mindset. And when you think about it, it's really only the person that's dealing with it that affects, you know, it's weirdly enough.
I don't want to sort of define you as someone who's, you know, worked with amazing artists that have sadly passed on. But I mean, you talked about the legend earlier on, and unfortunately we lost another genuine legend. That word can get bandied around, but, you know, Moya Brennan was just a powerful, exceptional force. And you worked on a song with her as well. And again, another incredibly special part of your career that doesn't relate necessarily to fame or album sales or whatever it might be. Just an amazing thing to have in the bank.
And it's funny, you spoke about accessible and accessibility earlier on about Daniel and people like that. And
Moya,
you know,
Brennan's a perfect example.
Maya's another perfect example, and she was so accessible. She never lost the run of herself in that respect, you know. And
even though she had every right to.
Absolutely.
If you look through what, you know, I didn't even, like, I was all the, and then she did the vocals for Saltwater. You know, I know that wasn't the biggest thing she did.
Yeah.
But when you look at what that lady achieved. Yeah. It's different genres and all over the place.
It's both commercial and, you know, very reputable stuff that she's done. You know, it's a bit of, it's everything. And, like, you know, let's not even talk about the fact that they had this huge hit with U2 and Bono, you know, in a lifetime. It's, I can remember walking over the bridge from Lifford to Stobban and buying that single when I was a kid in a place called Traffic, which was the you know, and just wanting to get it back to listen to it and just being immersed in that song for so long.
It's nothing like that feeling when you get your hands on a tape or a single.
Yeah, it's just, you know, and I can still remember that. And then to get to work with Maya, you know, years later or whatever, and it's, you know, it's so, yeah, the Maya thing, I mean, I've always just found her accessible, and she was, we had kind of, you know, met a few things, and then Kerry and Donegal met in a final a few years ago, 2012, 14, and I have great affiliation or love of Kerry for some reason. And it goes back to probably my kid, when I was a kid, going to Tralee with my mum and dad, and seeing James Last there in the park there, and the Gaelic Park and all that. And I just have this affiliation. And over the years, I've got to love Kerry. And I've got a lot of friends that are musicians for some reason. And for some reason, when I'm in Kerry, the terrain reminds me of Donegal. Mm. It's got that ruggedness still. They've tapped into the tourism thing a bit better than us.
Yeah, I've got the weather though,
but
you see it helps.
It helps a bit as well. So, but when Kerry and Donegal met, I said, I want to kind of mark both. And I wrote this song, From Gador to Tralee, it's called, you know. And then I started to think Gador, and I thought, oh, geez, Maya, I wonder if Maya would be interested in singing on this, you know. So I reached out to her and just said, listen, I have the song, I'll send it on to you. I'd love you to. And she came back and said, yeah, I'd love to sing on this.
Oh, wow.
And it was as simple as that. Like, and I sent her that. I recorded it up in Attica here with Tommy, and I've got a band of guys together. Some of the guys from in their thousands at the time, Declan and that, and a few of them. And we recorded the song or the track up there, sent it off. And Aisling has a studio, her daughter, Aisling, who lives here in Letterkenny now, and in Dublin at the time. And they put the vocals down up there, and Maya done her thing, her Clannad-esque kind of thing, and we...
And of course, Donegal, as we record this, Donegal due to play Kerry at the weekend, and may well meet in a final down the line.
Yeah, that's
I wasn't aware this song existed, so we're going to have to dust that off.
Yeah, I'm going to... I tell you, it's funny, I was in touch with... Because I listened to it, and I would like to try to do a mix of it again, you know, that kind of way now, because it's, you know,
so
it's
when
fine.
You do that, right, do you have all separate tracks, that?
Yeah.
So you have...
I'm hoping... Because I don't have it, and I was on to Tommy, and I said, Tommy, do you have this anywhere? Because I have a funny feeling I don't have it saved. Well, it's because one of those things, sometimes you get the master and you forget to get the tracks, and normally I have them and I save them onto a hard drive and they're there somewhere,
could be there somewhere,
or whatever. Yeah, so I'm hoping that I would love to just do it, give it another little go, you know, and maybe get Aisling involved in it or something like that, you know, just have when the time's right. But hopefully I'll have the option. But yeah, it's just one of those things. And she, and we did some promotion for it. I remember she was so good. I remember us doing, I think we did a Highland thing up in Dublin up one time in the Bonnington or something like that. They were doing an OB or something. And Maya, I'll come in and sing it. And we sang it live, you know. So amazing. She was she was, you know, no problems.
I presume... most people listening know, or maybe they don't know, that one of the most prolific songwriters in this country is Derek Ryan. He's an amazing performer in his own right, but that guy can write a song.
Absolutely.
And you've been working with him recently, or have you had a working relationship over time? Or
no, it's recently enough, to be honest, but we've always kind of... we've had mutual friends and band members who would have been in bands. Not that I'm, you know, in that scene, but, you know, people, that's the way it goes, you know.
Well, you're definitely, at the very least, you're scene adjacent.
I think absolutely. You are scene, and right? you kind of fall into it. You're never far away from it, and musicians and all that in the studios and everything. But I just got to know Derek, I suppose, through songwriting, and my songwriting tweaked his interest, and his songwriting tweaked my interest. And then we were talking about it, we'd met a few times. Can't even remember how, but but he's more recently we started to be seriously, and we've finished stuff, you know. We've had, I suppose, 3 or 4 ideas and maybe two or three kind of proper songs done now, demos.
Is that sort of like he works along with you on some of the stuff you've been working on, and then you sort of do the Mickey Joe Hart influence on some stuff he's written, or do you start from scratch together and try and create something? Or
normally we bring something. You know, that's the way it has worked for us. And I always find that that's not always the best way. It depends just what your time restraints are and all those things, and what might you think might work. I spent the day with him in his place, and he spent the day with me down Downing's. And in between. And then the great thing nowadays is you can share so much. I've done so much remotely.
I always wonder if I was Derek Ryan. Listen, we know the money's in the songwriting, right? But, you know, like, how do you pick which song you let someone else have you know, and say, right, I'm going to do that one.
It's tricky for him.
I'm going to sell out the 3 Arena on this one. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Or do I give that to the Tumbling Paddies or Mickey Joe Hart?
Well, you can always take it back.
Can you? I don't know. Like, I think even Ed Sheeran regrets giving some of his songs away when he sees them become massive for someone else. Yeah. But you're enjoying that. You have new music. Is it for singles? Is it for EPs? Is it for an album? I don't know. What do you want to do with your music going forward? How do you want to release it? What do you want from
it? It's so confusing, and I think that's why I've had a lack of music release, to be honest, seriously, because at the minute, I had a serious issue with Spotify because of just the whole links and my ethos on, you know, and that's my stuff is still on Spotify, but I haven't put anything new on it in recent years, which it's tricky. And I'm kind of like on that stage where I'm thinking about taking everything from it. I don't know.
As that's an advertising hoarding?
I think it's more about the moral kind of aspects of it.
No, I get it.
You know, that's where I am at the minute with it, and I haven't kind of moved on that yet. But anyway, there are so many aspects out there at the minute, but I'm exploring other avenues at the minute of releasing, and some of my back catalogue as well. I've just started to explore some places to get that up on as well.
Like Bandcamp and places like that.
Yeah. So, at the minute, but primarily, sorry to answer your question, but more straightforward.
Not because the back catalogue is the way I said right at the very beginning, like new audience are discovering you all the time. As we sit here now, and this is maybe where the Spotify things is good, but as we sit here now, Spotify might have chucked one of your tracks into a sequence. And as we speak, there could be a 15-year-old, a 55-year-old that's hearing one of your songs for the first time and then trails it back. So I think it's fantastic. Would you want to remaster your older stuff or just make it available in the one place with new stuff?
I think it's fine. I mean, I don't know. The remastering thing is a whole other thing. But no, I mean, I'm happy enough in Soundwave sonically and all those kind of things. I know there's things you can do. You can remaster things now specifically for Spotify or specifically for, you know, a certain... platform,
and
you
then
know,
but
they
people
have,
get vinyl to try and bypass all of that because they don't like overproduce.
I've just seen some really good proactive people in doing, and that, you know, it's kind of a one-on-one kind of thing. People just pay you directly for your album and you send them out a physical album. I love the aspect of that. But I suppose at the minute I'm certainly focused on doing an album. That's where I'm kind of at. I've done a lot of singles and a lot of other projects, as we spoke about there, and different, you know, different kind of things. And so, but primarily I'm trying to focus on getting the right people, the right vibe, and I've done a lot of pre-production, I suppose, in Downing's and places like that, just working on that and getting ideas.
So
I have a shed load of stuff.
But yeah, it's just so again, sorry, these are probably stupid questions, but it interests me about musicians. When you're putting something together now, is it for commercial success, or is it for artistic expression? Or do you try and find a sweet spot between the two? So at this point in your career, are you making the album that you want to make for you and where you're at, or you have one eye on the commercial, both eyes on the commercial success of it, or commercial reach?
That's a very good question, and it's something that I've been, you know, that I suppose over the years I find. I think the next album and this album will be for me.
Mm.
And it will be just, I'm just going to record these songs as I feel in my heart and soul and my head where they're sitting best. And I'm going to try and detach the sort of commercial aspect of it for the next album, because I've always felt...
freeing is that though?
Yeah, absolutely. Because you sometimes get, you know, it's different, you know, if I'm writing with Derek and we have a plan and we, you know, and he knows what his audience are and he wants to, you know, and or you know, a thing on the go with Nathan at the minute, and that might all come, that'd be nice to happen as well. But it's very much so that type of thing. And, you know, you have to work within certain perimeters to a certain extent. You know, there's a lot of freedom in it too. But for this, it's like this project that I need to do what I want to do is very much so just about putting it out there. And, you know, I found that in the past when I've done that, that's sort of been the way, that's sort of been what I've got the best reaction from, for some reason. Maybe not commercially, but,
the
you know.
I think the other projects you talk of are nice and exciting, and collabs and that type of stuff. But the one thing, too, it's a little bit about radio, is your audiences figure you out very, very quickly. And it doesn't surprise me that stuff that maybe was the truest to you or what you want would resonate most with the people that connect most to your music.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's always on a conscious level. I think sometimes it's on a, you know, a subconscious level.
Like, yeah. You know? So. Absolutely. And, you know, you can sometimes overthink these things an awful lot, you know, and I tend to do that, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm an overthinker or something. People would tell
But I think that, once you decouple it from sort of, when you're not engaging success on constantly checking downloads or sales or whatever, there's a freedom comes with that, especially when you've got the other commercial stuff you've hinted at rumbling on. You know what I mean? It gives you that space for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, it's nice to be kind of like, I know I have a lot of, you know, a lot of back catalog, let's say, put it like that. You know, I have a lot of things in the tank, let's say, that they, you know, I can always kind of fall back on or have it there, sort of, as you say, rumbling away. And so it doesn't, you know, mean that I'm not, you know, this, I'm not trying to, you know, sell myself on the next album, you know. It's so yeah, I mean, just the freedom of that. I've in recent years, was something that I'd never been able to do was to record myself and have the skills to do that. I've learned to do that over the last few years, and that I have a producer friend in Germany who helped me a lot with that. So that, and that meant that I can set up and my little hovel in Downing's, as you know, and have something that's very basic, but very...
Same here.
Everyone's
got little spaces in Downing's stuff.
Yeah, but it works for me, and it allows me to do that I never could do before. So I can do, I recorded with a song called Dairy Girl a few years ago.
Yeah, it was a brilliant track.
Yeah, yeah. With Tommy up in Attica here. And it was the first time that I'd sent him on tracks to a studio and said, this is the, you know, I'd done a lot of pre-production on it. You know, I sat down and worked out the tempos and worked out the arrangement and worked pretty much and sent him that. And I remember going into the studio in the morning, he had the drummer in to drum and they were using my track to drum off. And I was thinking, Jesus, this is the way to go. You know, I know it was like a light bulb moment because it's working for me, because I suppose it meant that 50 or 70% of what I given we used. and it just sped up the whole process, and it just made it a much more enjoyable experience that we weren't starting from scratch and, you know, and sitting down with the drummer and saying, I want the bass drum there, and I want, you know, we had a lot of stuff done.
And you had the experience to be able to stand over what you'd created. I don't want to start a big thing before we wrap up, but the one thing I would imagine in this country, and you can correct me if I'm wrong in this as well, is that, you know, I know the locals do an awful lot and the regional stations do an awful lot to try and support people's music, but, you know, there seems to be a big platform for superstars, right? I mean, it's crazy how much one artist in this country dominates the IMRO payouts.
Yeah.
You know, it's one fella and he's doing amazing, and fair play to him. And then it's blooding, like, you know, new talent. Some of it's not amazing, but they're getting national play and that's fine. But there's a whole group of people in the middle, or not even the middle, but not in those two spaces, that are, I wonder, how do you get into this circle? Or how do you hit the big time again with the track? Because I don't really see a pathway to that.
Yeah.
I don't actually can't figure out a pathway to it.
No. And I don't know. I mean, the whole social media thing is one way, you know.
You doing it yourself. I'm on about sort of traditionally.
And, oh, yeah, traditionally.
You know, I mean, you're fantastic. Yeah. You can reach your own audience whichever way you choose to.
Yeah.
But I'm on about the industry in the country. Yeah. It's just...
And the problem, you know, one of the problems is that, like, you know, I speak to people who are, you know, like yourself, you're very, you know, supportive, let's say, of the arts and of, you know, musicians and stuff like that. And there's a lot of shows and people throughout the country who are like that. But you tend to find that they're in the evenings or they're at night or they're a little...
And they're in pockets as well.
Yeah.
You know, and I know more people listen to radio, independent radio, that's fine. But the truth is there's also something special that comes with the national platform as well.
And I'll tell you, I'll give you a wee example of that. And this is, you know, it's going to sound like the old man of the road again. But I remember we... one of the first things that I raced on my own label was Sound of the Summer, which was really, we loved that song. I wrote it fairly quickly on a whim and got into the studio and got it all together because I wanted it out for the summer. Kind of, I wrote it about Brian Wilson. I watched this, you know, the Beach Boys singer, and I watched this documentary called Beautiful Dreamer, and it really inspired me. I literally went up the stairs, left the guitar, and started to write this song, Sound of the Summer, and we got it out. But I remember going physically into RTE when you were able to go in, if you knew one person, and I did, I was lucky enough that I was after Eurostar and Eurovision, so I had this one or two contacts, and I was able to go around with a bag of CDs, literally, and I can remember having a bag of CDs going around into RTE and sort of saying, oh, how's it going, whoever, Mary was at the reception, and blagging your way in, and then you'd, oh, I have a meeting with such, you'd have one person, but you'd go around to all the desks, and you'd leave your CD in all the desks. And lo and behold, some one of them would pick up for it and you'd hear it on. And the same in Today FM. I remember doing it with Ray. You know, who made a meeting with Ray, and you go around the rest of them and you'd go to Brian Adams, who was the radio controller at the time, music controller and stuff like that. And if they liked it, and, you know, getting an email saying, oh, we really like this, we're going to put it in the playlist.
Yeah, that would be a big deal.
And that was, and doing that radio tour and going around all the regionals and doing the same and picking out your favorite. And the next thing, you find them on the playlists, you know. Now, it also depended, obviously, on the track. They weren't just doing your favorite. So, but I remember it would actually physically do that. And nowadays, there are so much restrictions on the playlists within radio stations. I can't talk for Highland. I don't know, but there are,
We don't do playlists here.
Yeah,
but I know there's stations whereby you cannot choose what to play.
No,
and the DJ comes in and speaks between the tracks.
Oh, completely. And
we might end up there, but we're not there yet.
Yeah, and I know because I like yourself, I have people that, you know, DJs and broadcasters in the business who would tell me that, and, you know, on the QTs or say, Mickey, I'd love to play your new single, but I can't, you know, and that's the difference between now and, let's say, 20 years or 10 years ago, even, you know, where it's so heavily playlisted now. And even
I just
even
wish
RTE
radio would stop trying to compete with Spotify. I wish radio would...
Should be its own thing.
I think it should actually do its own thing. Absolutely. And I believe the downfall of music radio, and it's accelerated in Britain with every radio station now being part, is they've tried to compete with...
Yep.
Spotify.
Well, they're checking the Spotify playlists
for
the week,
and
that's they're basing their playlists.
And they're saying, they're saying, well, we'll play it here because then people won't listen on Spotify, rather than sort of driving something, a new product. But anyway, we are where we are at.
No, you're right, but it's difficult. It's more difficult. You know, there was a time when the royalties would come in and it would be something that could support you for a little bit, and that has all changed for a lot of writers out there, where you just don't have that network, that support anymore, you know.
Yeah. People can keep an eye on MickeyJoeHart.com and on Facebook /MickeyJHart and on Instagram MickeyJoeHart. And that's really where people can find out, because we've been talking about people. You might have five albums released by the time someone listens to this, sorry. My point being is that that's the go-to place to find out when you're going to be releasing music and all that type of stuff. Sounds like you're not putting yourself under pressure.
No, I have lots of little things, and I have a few other wee projects that I'm just really enjoying as well. But I go back to, you know, my place, and I have a little studio, and I will review everything, and every so often then I go mad and sort of, you know, get it into some sort of shape, and it's getting there. But I'm not putting myself under pressure. I do like to keep gigging as well, so that's important. And you know, I have to earn a living, so I have to keep doing that. And that's so yeah, in between those gaps, I'm trying to write an album. So that's I have it written, but I just can't get it all together. I mean, it's all the bits are there, and I have to finish off.
Do you trust someone to say, right, that's it, hands off, Mickey Joe?
Yes, a few people, and I'm in the process of working with someone at the minute that I hopefully will help me to get this album to that point.
Brilliant. Well, listen,
so that's where
thanks for fitting us in the middle of all that. You don't want to mention any names,
no? No, I won't say. It's just someone that I trust, and we've worked on things, and they've worked out really well. Good. And so I'm hoping that they will be the nucleus to get me to the next stage, because sometimes there's so many things going on in your head, it gets a bit cloudy.
Well, that's what I was going to say. That's why I asked the question, because, like, I mean, especially with access to the tracks, you just go in and go, right, okay, so you need a time, you need help signing off.
Yeah, you can go down a rabbit hole, you know, and you can, and it gets, honestly, you know that old saying, you can't see the wood for the trees.
Yep.
It really is. That's about as best as I can put it.
That's like a good lyric.
Yeah.
Mickey Joe Hart, thanks very much indeed.
Thanks, guys.
A big thanks once again to Mickey Joe Hart. Really enjoyed that. Don't forget, if you enjoyed it, we've got a whole host of podcasts now for you to listen back to on the Highland Radio website. Just search out The Greg Hughes Podcast. We're on Spotify. Again, just search The Greg Hughes Show, and also on Apple Podcasts as well. If you've any feedback or any suggestions, feel free to contact the researcher and producer of this podcast. That's Caroline Orr. Her email address is caroline.orr@highlandradio.com. We'll be back with another episode for you real soon. Thanks for listening.